I speak for myself, but I know from other people too, we are having tremendous fun. It's very rich material. And I have been going to Ferenczi conferences since 1991 at the new school where the whole thing began, the recognition of Ferenczi. And this is really, really a fantastic event. Thank you very much. The first presenter is Tom Keeve. He's going to be talking about Ferenczi and the Jung dossier. Tom lives and works here in Hampstead, London. Tom was born in Budapest and immigrated to England in 1956. Tom is a scientist with a PhD from Imperial College. He's a fellow of the Institute of Physics. Tom is fluent in four languages, and I think he's equally fluent in same amount of fields, which is physics, quantum physics, psychoanalysis, and Central European Jewish history. Tom is also the co-editor with Judith Sekach of this wonderful, wonderful two books, Ferenczi and His World, and Ferenczi for Our Time. I would like to ask Tom to come and present his paper.
Thank you very much for the introduction. It is actually longer than my paper is going to be. if you spent the last 2 days in this room, you'd be forgiven for thinking that all Hungarians are psychoanalysts. And I'm here to tell you that it's not true. There is a small minority of us who are fighting back. Some of you know that I like triangles, or as I like to call them, triads. And I'd like to remind you that the early days of psychoanalysis, the period 1908 to 1913, were dominated by a triad, with Freud at the apex, of course, and Jung and Ferenczi as the two bases, two lower points on an equal level. And much has been written about Ferenczi and Freud, and whole libraries are filled with relationship between Jung and Freud, but relatively little, a handful if that, has been paid, has been written about the third side of the triangle, which is the relationship between Ferenczi and Jung. When, through the generosity of Judith DuPont, the Ferenczi archives arrived in the museum, first thing I wanted to know personally was whether there was any correspondence between Jung and Ferenczi, and I expected nothing. And to my surprise, there were six letters. Two apparently have been published in Coqueron, but the others unpublished, and in English, all of them unpublished. There's also one letter from Emma Jung to Ferenczi. Only one side of this correspondence exists, or at least is known extent. I've checked with the Jung archives and also with the Jung family, and they have no letters from Ferenczi. The letters that we have here are only a subset, because there are other references in the literature, and the letters themselves make it obvious that there have been other letters. What we have here, then, is one half of a correspondence over 5 years, or I should say probably about half of one side of the correspondence. First slide, please. Oh, it's there. So I will use the slides to try and put into context the letters in terms of what else was happening at the same time. Jung started corresponding with Freud in 1906, and the two of them first met in March 1907. From Vienna, Jung continued on to Budapest, where he was introduced to Ferenczi by Philip Stein, a neurologist, who was already familiar with Jung's work and already knew Jung from Zurich. Ferenczi had been made familiar with Jung's work by the same Dr. Stein, and he was particularly positive about Jung's association experiments. The two men met, immediately connected, and started an extensive correspondence. Prior to Ferenczi's first meeting, Freud, Jung and Ferenczi had already exchanged 5 or 6 letters, as is made clear in the first letter that I'm going to talk to you about. I'm actually going to read out these letters to you. So the first letter is dated October the 1st, 1907. Dear colleague, many thanks for your news. They have been formally lost. Now, this is correspondence between people who didn't expect their letters to be read out in a meeting, you know, 100 years later, and they're obviously referring things that have been going on in previous letters. I think this means that Ferenczi gave some news and asked Jung not to transmit it any further. I've always regretted that you did not have more time available, which indeed was the case for me. I too have only had the opportunity for some wise words, but not for sound scientific work, which always does one good, even when one does not wish to publish anything scientific. So now I feel some sentiment d'incomplétude, in French, for you, specifically because you were not able to reap the full potential benefit. Correspondence, of course, is in German. We have established a Freudian society here that meets once every 14 days. This is 1907. Our first meeting was held last Friday, where Dr. Meyer and Dr. Ricklin gave presentations. Next slide, please. There were 12 people in attendance, and I recommend that later, when you have seduced more people to come over to Freud, you do the same. Something of this nature is uncommonly stimulating. This, incidentally, is part of the letter. The physical letter was on exhibition in the museum on the first floor in the first cabinet. Letter goes on. The Jandrasik criticism doesn't surprise me. Jandrasik. Jandrasik was a professor of neuropathology in Budapest, and he was the leading opponent of psychoanalysis. I think it's true that he usually comes into the Ferenczi story much later. This being 1907 is a very early reference to him. Here, even with Bezzola, who only lives for Freud, it's the same thing. I have noticed that in Amsterdam, the locals know shockingly little and are therefore almost idiotically critical. It is very observant of you that you have forgotten something here. I will send it to you right away. I will relay everything to Dr. Meyer. No idea what this refers to. Now Jung goes into some analysis in a noticeably superior tone. When I compare your last letter with earlier letters, which means there have been a number of letters, I notice that your handwriting has altered remarkably. In the spirit of Freud, I allow myself the following remarks. Your earlier letters displayed symptoms of light Gezietheit, which is translated as affectation. But then he explains what it means, which has now quite disappeared. And in parentheses, Gezietheit is dissatisfaction with one's social position, repressed ambition, and unfulfilled wishes, wanting to impress and wanting to please. This is this letter. The current handwriting is stronger, more natural, the feelings are allowed to surface. In the beginning, the letter showed some inhibition. Very early on, there was an impression of intellectual competition in the form of the address, in the very honored sir, in Sehr geehrter Herr, where your S, and that's up there, brings to mind very strongly the sexual complex, the sexual element. Your self-esteem now appears stronger and more natural than previously. Earlier, L, now alpha, etc. I don't know what the L means, but maybe you can enlighten me. Please forgive me, but one's profession never lets go. Please receive the most hearty greetings from your devoted Jung. And then as footnote, greetings to Dr. Stein. Can we go back one? Yeah. This is the first letter we have, as I said, but it's clear from the discussion that there have been a number of letters before, which means that in the period of March to October of 1907, there were about six letters or more exchanged between the two. a month later, in November, on November 8th, 1907, and, no, I think we'll stay. Jung wrote his second letter, second in the sense, the second that we have here. Very dear colleague, changed from dear colleague in the previous letter. Please accept my thanks for the interesting article from the British Medical Journal, which I read immediately and with pleasure. I must excuse myself that I had not answered your last letter for such a long time. I'm so inundated with work that my correspondence has been neglected. I now have two assistants in the laboratory who give me much to do. Recently, I have been made honorary fellow of the American Institute for Scientific Research, a society that primarily studies psychology and occult phenomena. This is the first reference, and it's clear that Ferenczi and Jung had been discussing paranormal items in their correspondence and the occult from the beginning of their relationship. I just want to add that psychical research was quite an acceptable scientific topic in the, at that time, not like today. And it was supported, amongst others, by the American psychologist William James and the British scientist Sir James Jeans. Later, yeah. I continue with the letter. He's still talking about the honorary fellowship. This was awarded to me on the grounds of my dissertation. Then he goes on to say, our Freud Society is blooming. We now have 22 members. Hopefully you're creating a good school in Budapest also. Now Jung changes topics, which seem to be a list of items that they discussed earlier. And it just goes with headings. Regarding graphology, the book by Crapio-Jamin is to be recommended, as well as Laura Meyer von Albertini, which is even better. On brooding, which is Grübelsucht. Why do people brood? Transference of the libido from compensation of some defects in sexuality to intellectual operation. And these are notes, they not always have a verb in. So. I believe analysis is not complete. The trauma of the past truly emerges, but the conflict of the present is not obvious. Why hold on to false evaluation of the libido? Have you tried to allow all thoughts, which in turn present themselves in a quiet state of concentration, to simply come? In such cases, everyday false connections, so to speak, must occur, which must be elucidated subsequently. Such treatments always take a long time. In the case of young writers, I have considered dementia praecox. It does not automatically prevent success. In a third case, there was no second, a jurist, it remains to be found out why he feels such aversion in conjunction with masturbation. This must be analyzed, that is to say, educated away. Suggestion in hypnosis often works well in such cases. Compulsives are often able and gifted people. It is the hysteria of the morally strong. Next paragraph is single sentence. Your case of thought transference is very interesting. Then he says, if you have the chance, would you repeat the experiments which I described in my dissertation? I've looked it up, and Jung's doctoral dissertation discussed the case of his girl cousin, a young girl with a dissociative disorder, who also was an excellent medium. And numerous seances are described in this dissertation. The letter goes on. The exteriorization of complexes is a wonderful problem. Lately, I have had some interesting experiences in this regard. The physical phenomena of spiritism also follow Freud's laws. Through analysis, I have been able to eliminate abruptly physical sounds. In one of the latest issues of the Neue Deutsche Rundschau, there is a report of a very interesting case in this regard, the case of Karin. Best wishes to you and Dr. Stein from your devoted Jung. Next slide, please. We now come to 1908. Excuse me. 4th of January, that's another letter from Jung. its tone is increasingly close, but it concentrates on professional matters. And it makes it clear that Ferenczi has been describing a number of his cases in letters to Jung. Dear colleague, my thanks for your long and detailed letter. I admire your ability of transforming fundamental turmoil into clarity and exploring your cases so profoundly. It goes without saying that I am extraordinarily grateful to you for these communications from your material, for I lack such material entirely as yet. Regarding the man with the ear affection and the voices, I hope it's not infection, I fully agree with your explanation. The functional, parenthesis, hysterical symptom always likes to localize itself in a place of least resistance. Many years ago, I was able to notice this in myself. For a long time now, I've been suffering from a slight, very high-pitched ringing in the ears. For a while now, I have noticed that whenever I'm in a hypnagogic state, I hear the magnificent voice of an opera singer as if she was singing in the next room. Around this time, I was in love with a young lady who possessed a magnificent singing voice. As it turned out later, I had a similar auditory illusion. Complexes slip into hypnagogic visions in the same way, or the location of a physical trauma later becomes the scene of a hysterical manifestation. Physical dysfunctions always force increased cathexis on themselves. Any such cathexis must attract those complexes which are an integrating component of the personality. A traumatic complex is assimilated in just this way into existing complexes for which there are innumerable examples. You would oblige me very much by communicating your cases, for thereby I gain valuable material for comparison. I cannot quite assess your cases of delayed epilepsy since I do not know them. Therefore, I do not know whether they are suitable for publication. I rather believe that your other complex analyses, i.e. those that are particularly telling, are suitable for publication. The literature lacks such material in particular and may also interest a broader stratum of physicians. current analyses are still much too complicated for the average neurologist. I expected a laugh there. Your observations from your daily practice might do much good in this respect. My Amsterdam talk will, it is hoped, soon appear in print. I will send you an off-print. I very much hope to be able to greet you at the Freud meeting in Salzburg this spring. With best regards and wishes for the new year, your devoted Jung. This letter was 4th of January, and on 8th of January, which presumably is just after receiving the letter from Jung, Ferenczi wrote to Freud for the first time. Jung had written the previous year to Freud, telling him about Stein and Ferenczi. So, I carry on, miss all those items out. There's some interesting points there, but on December 12th, we get to another letter from Jung. My dear colleague, most of all, thank you for your kindly sending your off-print, which I had already read with great interest, in Breslau's journal. I noticed that the difference between then and now has not become great with you. I am very grateful to you for the news that you have provided regarding your current way of living. I'm particularly pleased to hear that you can now work purely psychoanalytically. That must be especially satisfactory for you. I'd rather understand that you are becoming a focus of hostility, for I am in a similar position. Close colleagues in particular can hardly contain themselves. Of course, it is also the fear of competition that is behind all this. As you probably already know, I am withdrawing for working exclusively in the madhouse. Yes, he uses the word Irrenhaus to describe one of the premier psychotherapeutic clinics in Europe, because, and work partly practically, partly theoretically. This requires all my strength. I also have a lot to do with the Jahrbuch. So far, the influx of material is substantial. We have some space available in the second half-year volume, which I gladly place at your disposal for a not-too-extensive publication. In closing, may I request that you accept my highly indecent and long silence. It says nothing except that I'm very much taken advantage of, and this leaves me no time to write. If you kindly write to me, I shall reply. In a non-righteous sense, a man of the moment, but otherwise not so bad. I would like to send you an off-print too, but I don't have anything, as my disciples gobble up all my remaining time. A little piece will appear in the forthcoming first half-year volume of the Jahrbuch. Everybody can look forward to Freud's work. That is something magnificent. With best regards and wishes, your always devoted Jung. Next slide, please. Now we move into 1909. And remember all the time how early this is in the story of psychoanalysis. We've been listening the last 2 days really for to 1931, 32, of course, 33, Lowry, and most of the other references refer to the 20s. Now, Freud comes into the picture here. Very interesting little remark from Jung to Freud on June 18th, 1909, where he says, "We shall both be very nice to Ferenczi." And this is in the context of their forthcoming trip to the United States, when they're going to be together for 6 weeks. The invitation to Clark University to give lectures is often taken as a milestone for Freud coming onto the world stage. Jung was invited there to give lectures in his own right, whereas Ferenczi was there simply to accompany them at Freud's invitation. The three men spent 6 weeks together. captive to each other for about 2 weeks on the two transatlantic journeys, and they amused themselves by analyzing one another's dreams. Next slide, please. This period was the high point of the triangular relationship. By mid-1910, both Jung and Ferenczi occupied very special positions in the circle around Freud. Jung was the crown prince, while Ferenczi was the son or son-in-law Freud wished he had. In June of 1910, Freud wrote to Jung, "You know how jealous they all are over your privileged position with me. It's the same with Ferenczi. I mean, his closeness to me is equally begrudged." That mysticism and science are closely allied in their minds. I did say before that paranormal studies were not looked on as unscientific at that time. And another interesting phrase is Jung suggests to Freud in August 1910 that the slogan for psychoanalysis should be, "Let no one enter here who is ignorant of mathematics." Maybe I should not ask everybody who is ignorant of mathematics to leave. Next slide, please. In the following year, 1911, the study of the occult becomes a subject of correspondence in the Freud-Ferenczi-Jung triangle. Freud actually is positive in the beginning, but slowly reverses his position. On February 17, 1911, Freud wrote to Jung saying that he, that's Freud, has been elected to the Society for Psychical Research, which is it's a UK academic group that investigated paranormal phenomena. And then 3 months later, he wrote to Ferenczi famous words, which have been quoted many, many times. Jung writes that we must also conquer occultism and request permission to undertake a campaign in the realm of mysticism. I see that the both of you can't be restrained. You should at least proceed in harmony with each other. These are dangerous expeditions, and I can't go along there. To which Ferenczi replies, "I consider the fight against occultism to be premature, but I'm inclined to cooperate with Jung." And again, Freud replies to the response, which he says, "You and Jung ought to proceed together without my intervention." It's not that well. This is followed a month later by Jung's next letter to Ferenczi, where he discusses occult or mystical results obtained by Ferenczi and warns that the world is not ready for its publication. This is Jung warning Ferenczi that the world is not ready. And Jung then refers to his own mystical work. I will read the letter. Excuse me. So this is June the 12th, 1911. Thank you. Yes. "Dear friend, I would be delighted..." It's a move to friend from colleague. "Dear friend, I would be delighted if you would visit me in September during the weeks preceding the Congress. Freud and his wife are our guests, so that we cannot then put you up, but we can meet in spite of this. Putnam will be there also. I am extraordinarily interested in your results. What little I have achieved in this area, I will be happy to tell you, including the errors. I have no intention to publish these things, because I do not regard my results as sufficient. You are welcome to them if you want to make use of them. However, I do not think the time has yet come to present this to the public officially. We still have too few authorities on our side in psychoanalysis. I believe we must therefore be very cautious for the time being. Speaking confidentially, I am occupying myself most devotedly with the secret arts, as much as anyone in medieval times. but I do not let this be known publicly. I'm very busy. Life too has saddled me with some heavy burdens. With heartfelt greetings, your very devoted Jung. At this time, Freud was still wavering about mystical research. And on June 15th, he wrote to Jung, this is just after the previous letter, "In matters of occultism, I have grown humble since the great lesson Ferenczi's experiences gave me." But we're starting to get a transition point. By the end of 1911, friction has arisen between Jung and Freud. And for the next 12 months, they try to resolve this, or at least live with it. In October, Ferenczi also joins the Society for Psychical Research, to which his application is countersigned by Freud, his sponsor. Next slide, please. The 2 months of October and November 1911 is characterized by a new triangle of correspondence, and this is Emma Jung, Ferenczi, and Freud. A large number of letters are exchanged, which are listed there, but I won't go into them. We just know that the letters were exchanged. We don't have any of the letters except November 31. This letter, which is here in the museum, it looks like it might be dated 1910, but it's a bit ambiguous, and I'm pretty sure it should be 1911 because it fits totally into this chronology. That's also why I showed it. So this is now 31st of October. October? Yes, 31st of October, 1911, from Emma Jung to Ferenczi. "Dear Dr. Ferenczi, I thank you from my heart for your friendly and thorough letter, which I found very reassuring. I believe you are right when you speak out about what I called, in quotes, resistance by Freud, due to the fact that he is not fully in agreement with my husband's latest work. In fact, it was very noticeable to me, and of course also for my husband, that he said almost nothing about it. Only after you had reassured me that I mustn't be afraid to cause a problem, have I taken my heart in both hands and written to Freud and asked out direct what his opinion of the work was. I know my husband would be very happy because he feels the current position is something unnatural. Of course, he doesn't know that I wrote to Freud. Now I'm awaiting the reply very nervously and anxiously, and I may have started awkwardly. Nevertheless, the unconscious allows me no peace, and I console myself with the fact that one is actually seldom wrong when one follows one's instincts. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for your advice and your friendly attitude, and am, with best regards, your Emma Jung." I should say that during this correspondence, it's clear from the Freud-Ferenczi correspondence that whenever Ferenczi received a letter from Emma Jung, he sent the letter straight to Freud together with his proposed reply. We're dealing with a much less mature Ferenczi here than most of the last 2 days. And I would submit that a mature person would first send the reply and then say to Freud, "And this is what I replied." But there you are. So from here is downhill all the way. Throughout the following year of 1912, please, next slide, Freud's relationship with Jung deteriorated. By November 1912, Freud's letters to Jung began, "Dear Dr. Jung," having been dear friend for the previous 5 years. The last letter from Jung to Ferenczi, which we have, is dated, it's actually not the last letter, the next letter, let's say, November the 5th, 1912. I'm sorry, it is the last. "Dear friend," still dear friend, "as you saw, I had I had to add a slight softening to your polemic against Bleuler. His justification can be found in my libido work, part two, where I proposed an illumination of the infantile significance of the abstinence technique. The real reason for my writing is this. I must ask you in the name of a female patient if you would be willing to treat a Polish teacher, in parentheses history, at the miserly rate of 10 kronen. She has been with me for some time already, and I can recommend her to you as a very intelligent and amiable person. I have also charged 10 francs for treatment. Certain circumstances could result in her relocation to Budapest. With best regards, your devoted Jo. As I say, we're really going downhill very fast. In the early part of 1913, Jung wrote at least two more letters to Ferenczi. Again, we know this from the correspondence between Ferenczi and Freud. Ferenczi, again, forwarded these letters to Freud straight away with his proposed replies. And on April 20th, 1914, Jung resigned as president of the IPA. And as far as I know, this is the end of the Jung-Ferenczi relationship. In the clinical diary, to come back to the diary, there is a single mention of Jung, which is on the 4th of August, 1932. Under the heading, Personal Causes for the Erroneous Development of Psychoanalysis, Ferenczi wrote, point 1a, contrary to all the rules of the technique that he, Freud, established himself, he adopted Dr. Ferenczi almost like a son. As he himself told me, he regarded him as the most perfect heir of his ideas. Thereby, he became the proclaimed crown prince, anticipating his triumphal entry into America. And in parentheses again, Freud seems to have expected something similar. This is Ferenczi writing. Freud seems to have expected something similar of Jung years ago. Hence the two hysterical symptoms I observed in him, one, the fainting spell in Bremen, and two, the incontinence on Riverside Drive. So both these refer to their trip to the United States. To summarize, Jung and Ferenczi were on very friendly terms. They exchanged a large number of letters even before Ferenczi and Freud, or Freud met Ferenczi. Their friendship was close, cemented by their mutual interest in parapsychology and the occult. But later, like brothers, they were jealous of one another and vied for the father's, let's say, Freud's love. Jung broke away in order to be able to propound his own ideas, which were not supported by Freud. But Ferenczi remained with Freud triumphant. It was another 20 years before Ferenczi made his own break, for the very same reason, to be able to expound his own ideas. We know that the friendship between Jung and Ferenczi didn't survive Jung's split with Freud. And if you ask why not, it seems clear that it was because Freud would not have tolerated a continued intimacy. And it seems that at the time, Ferenczi didn't particularly wish it either. Or put it differently, he was not prepared to continue without Freud's approval. As a result, Jung had no other partner in his studies of mysticism, and Ferenczi, too, more or less moved away from this area without Jung's support against Freud's distaste. And now, finish on a provocative thought. Listening to all the talks in the last 2 days, I was struck by the fact that Ferenczi's ideas and state of mind at the end of his life, it occurred to me that had he survived the terminal episode and lived for a number more years, don't forget, there was only 2 years age difference between Jung and Ferenczi, and Jung did the bulk of the work that he's remembered for after Ferenczi died. I had the feeling that had Ferenczi lived longer, there might have been a rapprochement between him and Jung. silence. They had much in common. Both were, of course, by then disappointed in Freud and were developing their own ideas. André Hainaut said yesterday that Ferenczi was interested not only in psychoanalysis, but even more so in the development of personality. But this, of course, is also pure Jung. Under the label of individuation, he was advocating the same thing, that the aim of life... It's calm. It's, of course. Jung would have liked that. As I was just saying, this is pure Jung. You see? individuation is Jung would say that the aim of life is to truly know oneself. They were both interested in the occult, the paranormal. They were also both very interested in modern science and didn't really see a conflict between these interests. Furthermore, they concentrated on quite different aspects of the human condition. Ferenczi's case, the wise child or the child within, and Jung's strongest area really was midlife crisis in men. So one could say they were not even competitors in ideas. It made me think, and maybe it makes you think.
Hello. Tom very modestly did not include in his presentation that he translated these letters from German, and it's a very beautiful English into which you translated. That's number one. Number two, to decipher these letters is incredible. I mean, it really is incredible. The handwriting is something else to look at. The title of the second presentation is Mrs. Klein and the Diary. And the presenter is Isabel Halton. She's a member of the Institute for Psychoanalysis, and she's a chair of the Center for the Advancement of Psychoanalytic Studies, and her paper is going to be equally provocative, I'm sure.
Well, sometime towards the end of 1914, just after the death of her mother, Melanie Klein started her analysis with Ferenczi. She was deeply depressed, and it's important to point that she basically came to analysis as a patient. She didn't come because of the psychoanalytic training. And this has intensified by the death of her mother, with whom she had a difficult relationship. She seemed to have been in analysis with him until 1919, which for that time was an unusually long analysis. So we're talking about 5 years of analysis. At that time, it was really quite a long analysis. Although we do not seem to have any information of how often she had sessions with him. In this talk, I want to explore what Melanie Klein received from Ferenczi as evidence in the clinical diaries, and pinpoint some similarities and differences in technique with modern Kleinian psychoanalysis. It is felt by some, and I think with some reason, that Klein did not give her analysis with Ferenczi enough importance, and that it has been overshadowed by her much shorter analysis with Abraham, which lasted less than 18 months due to Abraham's premature death. If this is the case, could there have been some splitting going on here? And I think we need to revisit Ferenczi's writing, and today particularly his diaries, to give proper recognition to his contribution to Mrs. Klein's development. And I want to thank Judith for that, because if it hadn't been for giving this paper for this conference, I wouldn't have read the diaries otherwise. And I really found it very illuminating, and I want to share some of what I thought was illuminating. I think we need to revisit Ferenczi's writing, and today particularly his diaries, to give proper recognition to his contribution. Klein herself, in her autobiographical note, says of his first analysis, "There is much that I have to thank Ferenczi for. One thing that he conveyed to me and strengthened in me was the conviction in the existence of the unconscious and its importance for mental life. I also enjoyed being in touch with somebody who was a man of unusual gifts. He had a streak of genius." One would imagine that Ferenczi's capacity to be in touch and bear raw and psychotic parts of the personality is one of the unusual gifts Melanie Klein was referring to. And I think basically the whole issue of unconscious fantasy, you could see very clearly how much in touch he was with it. I think the clinical diary shows Ferenczi's ability and taste for working with the most difficult on patients and his ability to convey sympathy and awareness for their suffering. He was clearly not scared of the psychotic parts of the personality. And in page 32 of his diary, he tells us, "If we are not alarmed by this diagnosis, if we even urge patients to befriend these images, which have been so horrifying up to now, and do not reject a priori the possibility of the psychic reality or otherwise real nature of their observations, we will be rewarded in turn by the partial return of their interest in ordinary reality." So I think this is quite an astonishing thing to say, look, just embrace the psychotic bit. Do not be scared of it. And it is a difficult thing to do. I think that this gift that Melanie Klein talks about would have been there when Klein started her analysis. And in fact, Grosskorth, in her biography of Klein, states that she was indebted to Ferenczi for the importance that he attached to primitive emotional life. And this, for example, can be seen very clearly in his diary. And just take this entry on the 10th of April. "In this connection, the question arises whether the primal trauma is not always to be sought in the primal relationship with the mother, and whether the traumata of a somewhat later epoch, already complicated by the appearance of the father, could have had such an effect without the existence of such a pre-primal trauma, mother-child scar. The first disappointment in love, winning, etc., must have, in every case, a traumatic effect, that is, one that produces psychic paralysis from the first moment. The resulting disintegration makes it possible for new psychic formations to emerge. In particular, it may be assumed that a splitting occurs at this stage. The organism has to adapt itself, for example, to the painful realities of weaning, but psychic resistance against it desperately clings to memories of an actual past and lingers for a shorter or longer period in the hallucination. Nothing has happened. All subsequent disappointments later on in one's love life may well regress to this wish fulfillment. Now, I could have been fooled for thinking that those ideas came straight out of one of Klein's book. It is not surprising to hear then that Melanie Klein explained the origin of her life work like this. During this analysis with Ferenczi, he drew my attention to my great gift for understanding children and my interest in them, and he very much encouraged my idea of devoting myself to analysis, particularly child analysis. I would call this a pretty important contribution to Mrs. Klein's life and career and to the development of psychoanalysis. One of the consequences of Ferenczi's awareness and openness to early emotional life is that he could tune into his patients' nonverbal communications. Sandor Laurent, another patient of his, mentioned his constant alertness to emotional states, his awareness of the bodily movements, positions, gesticulations, modulations of voice, and the like. Not surprisingly, then, this led him to be aware of the centrality of the relationship analyst-patient and how the patient is scrutinizing the analyst in minute detail and can pick up on the analyst's true feelings if the analyst is trying to disguise them. This led him to what he called mutual analysis. And as you know, much of the clinical diary is devoted to this subject. Reading the diary, I could clearly recognize Ferenczi's search for freedom and authenticity in the analyst-patient relationship in the here and now, and how this must have influenced Melanie Klein and all the post-Kleinian analysts. I now want to focus on the technique of mutual analysis and some of the similarities and differences with how we work today. I have to be careful with two points here. Firstly, I think it is a fallacy to think that there's a uniform technique called Kleinian psychoanalysis. I can only talk from my experience of my own analysis and my own clinical practice. Secondly, there is a considerable time lapse between when the clinical diaries were written in 1932 and 18 years had passed since Melanie Klein had started with her analysis with Ferenczi. And so I'm sure that you're all aware that in kind of 18 years, how much time and how much your technique can change. But I would imagine that there were certain basic blocks that were there when Melanie Klein started her analysis in 1914. But even Melanie Klein herself refers to this fact when she was writing about her analysis with Ferenczi, and she says, "Technique at this time was extremely different from what it is at present, and the psychoanalysis of the negative transference did not enter. I had a very strong positive transference, and I feel that one should not underrate the effect of that, though. As we know, it can never do the whole job." Now, it's very interesting that Ferenczi had made exactly the same similar reproach to Freud regarding the negative transference. So that there was something, they were both aware that there was something about the negative transference that was still underdeveloped and that they needed to work on it. Much has been developed since the clinical diary, and the whole area of the analyst-patient relationship has moved enormously, and the whole area about negative transference has moved enormously like as well. An analyst like Paula Hyman, exploring the whole concept of counter-transference, or Betty Joseph, when talking about the transference as the total situation. And I think we would all agree and can absolutely see the influence of Klein and further development with Ferenczi, it's a real emphasis in the authenticity of the relationship between the analyst and the patient, and that it's a crucial part of our technique. Now, what do we mean by authentic? Ferenczi tells us in the diary, "The strongest impression on the patient was naturally made by my admission of personal and physical antipathies and a confession of my previously rather overdone friendliness." Or, politeness, that is the destruction of all hope of a real and more than merely professional countertransference. The fact is that every patient is analyzing their psychoanalyst carefully and will invariably reenact their internal world scenarios in the analysis. The struggle then is to differentiate what is projective identification and what does belong to the analyst, although most of the time it is a mixture of both. And I think one of the things that when you read the diaries, you are aware is that there was not, that he wasn't using the concept of projective identification, that there was something that followed, and that then it becomes very difficult to be able to help the patient to see what is part of your internal world and what is mine, and how at the same time it is always a mixture of both. Ferenczi does convey openness to his patients' examinations. Yet the difference in technique now, with the use of the concept of projective identification, is that we now see it as a complicated admixture of an observation and a projection. Few of us would not go along with Ferenczi when he asked the analysts to free themselves and have the courage to allow raw, primitive, sometimes psychotic feelings about one's patient. This is what Bion meant by the capacity for reverie and containment. And you do feel that Ferenczi passed that to Klein, that he did have a capacity to free himself, to be there with the patient and with whatever was happening with the patient, even if the patient and yourself did not want to allow that to happen, because it's very scary. And that was both, the genius that they both had. However, the question then is not only how much of what my patient sees about me is mine and how much is a projection. In terms of technique, there needs to be an assessment of what the analyst does with those feelings. What can the patient hear? And what effect will this have on the patient? At its worst, the technique of mutual analysis can lead to a blurring of boundaries between analyst and patient, a confusion of tongues. And Ferenczi himself, in page 45 of the diaries, guides us by saying, "In the meantime, one must be content with obtaining pieces of analytic insight from the patients in scattered fragments, and now not allow them to concern themselves with our person any more than is necessary for their analysis." Yet, this is quite a difficult struggle, because in the diaries himself, we hear that he talked about his masturbation activities with his patients, and their various examples of incidents went to my mind, "He's too self-revealing, and I would imagine that information could burden his patients." As we know, this is not an easy struggle or differentiation. It's quite difficult to know what is yours and what is mine and what can my patient hear. And Ferenczi himself was warned by Freud about the dangers of being too much under the influence of my patients. As psychoanalysis develops, we're increasingly aware of the inevitability of reenacting the patient's pathology in the treatment, and the importance of the need of a third position in our mind, and a third party in the form of a supervisor or a colleague to help us become more aware of the enactments. I am reminded of Freud's analogy that the work of the psychoanalyst is like that of the chemist in the laboratory, working with explosive materials. You know that they're dangerous and you have to be aware, but because the fact that they're dangerous doesn't stop you from working. And it's my impression that Ferenczi had the ability to and wanted us to be able to approach those explosive materials, and he was not didn't run away from them. Yet, in order to have the freedom to do so, we have to be first aware of the dangers and have as safe circumstances as possible by having very clear boundaries and by looking to somebody else to help you with the reenactment. And that's basically what I wanted to say. Thank
you. And thank you so much, Isabel. As I predicted, the paper very rich in ideas, and I'm sure you have a lot to say. The third presenter is Yves Legrand. The title of his paper is Lacan, Ferenczi, A Paradoxical Kinship. Yves is a member of the Freudian Society of Psychoanalysts in Paris, and he is the author of a book called Impardonable
Unforgettable.
Impardonable Ferenczi. And he is very well known in my circles because we published a paper by him as a person who really, really pushes the envelope. And this is wonderful. In other words, you like to provoke.
Okay.
Provocative ideas.
I mean, right. But first I want to thank all of the organizers for such a rich and friendly meeting in London. The relationship of Jacques Lacan and later of his students to the figure and work of Ferenczi falls under the curious and perhaps French phenomenon that Vladimir Granov detected early on. He is cited and translated here and there, but only on very rare occasions. He is marginalized. In the work of Lacan, this other enfant terrible of psychoanalysis, the marginalization of Ferenczi's influence has taken the form of a strange eclipse. Although Ferenczi clearly occupies a prominent role in the beginning of Lacan's teaching in the 1950s. But he all but disappears for the next rather long period and make an unexpected and paradoxical comeback after the death of Lacan. Today, about 30 years after this death, the situation has changed, leaving behind the passionate violence that formerly characterized it. The work and place of Ferenczi in the history of psychoanalysis has at least received increasing attention from certain analysts stemming from Lacanian circles. Some read Ferenczi in the light of Lacan's advances, thus holding to a Ferenczi after Lacan, while others sense that there is always a Ferenczi beyond Lacan. At the beginning of his teaching, it seems that Lacan sought to bring Ferenczi out of obscurity to which he has been relegated by the analytical community since his death. However, these first interactions with the psychoanalyst from Budapest remain muddled, even distorted, by his requisition by the French analytical scene in the 1950s, and by the relative inaccessibility of his work due to a lack of French translation. It took place prior to the precious editorial work of our friend Judith Dupont. The French scene was profoundly affected by the crisis and the split within the SPP, Paris Psychoanalytic Society, and by the rise of Lacan as the dominant figure in the new analytic society, the SFP, French Society of Psychoanalysis. Unsurprisingly, at the heart of this fratricidal strife is the question of analytical training, and in the backdrop lies controversy over both Lacan's teaching and practice. Within this heated context, Lacan, who was quite isolated from the international scene, sought support from Michael Balin, a major figure of the middle group, to whom he early wrote You may be assured that I always conduct a significant part of my teaching in the spirit line of Ferenczi. It seems that, moreover, Lacan's knowledge of Ferenczi's work at this point is rather fragmentary. It was, I think, the article, The Elasticity of Psychoanalytic Technique, which clearly caught his interest more than confusion of tones between adults and children, which had been recently translated in French. This brilliant article, luminous article, he said, will lead him to consider Ferenczi as the analyst who was the most tormented by the problem of analytical action and the first generation author who most relevantly raised the question of what is required of the analyst as a person, in particular as regards the end of the treatment. However, there is some ambiguity with respect to these emphatic words of praise and to what Lacan designated as Ferenczi's school of authenticity, since the desire to create a school was never Ferenczi's, but only Lacan's one. But authenticity like freedom and sincerity. Thus, Ferenczi figured early as an involuntary soldier in what has been called the Hundred Years' War of Psychoanalysis in France. It was, as previously noted, through Michael Balin that Lacan first discovered not the entirety of Ferenczi's work, but only one off side of it, namely the one that shows Ferenczi interrogating and contesting the principle of training analysis, la didactique in French. To put things bluntly, Lacan first invokes Ferenczi's authority as Freudian collateral for what he controversially termed his return to Freud. Even if Lacan tries to identify himself with Ferenczi, his own instrumentalization of him is clear. The man of Budapest asked the right questions, but lacked the right tools to escape the snares of imaginary and to pave the way for answers. Lacan sought, of course, the solution lay in his own promotion of the symbolic. Surprisingly, even if he had read The Confusion of Stone, Lacan never mentioned the article nor Ferenczi's interest in the field of speech and language. In his article on obscene words, Ferenczi examined perhaps in more depth than Freud in his study of jokes, the linguistic register of each drive-related age of faith as jouissance infiltrates language. Likewise, when he introduces the major variation in his practice, i.e. variable length sessions, Lacan does not refer to Ferenczi's experiments in technique. We can ask ourselves in hindsight, is it a misrecognition of the fact or a deliberate stance? In the first years of the life of the SFP, the new psychoanalytic institution in which Lacan seems to march under the banner of Ferenczi, the polyglot Vladimir Granov, also a brilliant and cautious student of Lacan, distanced himself from him by promoting a more clinical and less fragmented and or political reading of Ferenczi's work. His more analytical reading privileged the dimension of trauma, the traumatized child, and its return through regression into the ordinary aspects of the everyday practice. This makes Granoff the first Ferenczian analyst in France. Much to Lacan's scandal, Granoff would publicly endorse his alternative reading of Ferenczi at the momentous colloquium of Voyaumont, for which the eloquent title of his lectures maintains, I believe, its relevance today. Ferenczi, false problem or true misunderstanding? In this heated context of the 1950s, which linked itself to transferential savagery, and which constituted a period of conflation between psychoanalysis and politics, Ferenczi featured once again at the heart of a profound psychoanalytic disagreement with which led to the disintegration of the new and promising SFP in the fall of 1963. Lacan's references to Ferenczi fade and critics become more explicit when he founds his own school, the Freudian School of Psychoanalysis. Contrary to one's expectation, Lacan does not refer to Ferenczi's work on trauma when, at a later point of his own teaching, he comes back to the question of trauma to broach the dimension of the real, and of jouissance. Even more surprisingly, tormented as much as Ferenczi by the process of becoming an analyst, Lacan proposed a new institutional procedure for the recognition and appointment of analysts of the school, without ever mentioning Ferenczi. This proposition, he named the PASS, which subverted all the classical standards of accreditation, would go on to tear apart the Lacanian community. Presumably, at this time, Lacan keeps away more and less deliberately from Ferenczi, who was nevertheless the first to question the analysis of the analyst, and to maintain that there is no special training analysis. Paradoxically, although Lacan seems to be unaware of the whole of Ferenczi's work, to hold him at a distance from current debates, characterizes it, the work and place of Ferenczi in the history of psychoanalysis, as at last receiving increasing there is Lacan and there is his pupil, and it was not the same thing with his pupils. The same could not, however, be said of those students of his who were most engaged in the Lacanian adventure. Third period, after death of Lacan. In the winter of, the journal Ornicard will dedicate his 35th issue to the odd combination of Ferenczi and Reich, published during the continuing turbulent emotional climates. Its article, written by advocates of hard and fast Lacanianism and by supporters assured about the past, present a severe indictment against Ferenczi. Consider only the title of the following articles. The Ferenczi case. Ferenczi judged by Freud and Lacan, and Ferenczi's parapraxis. But even if it's in the name of Lacan that they condemn the Ferenczi, these texts put him at the center of the current Freudian debate over the training and recognition or certification of analysts. Whether critical or not, well-founded or not, these texts on Ferenczi attest to the retreat of the strange eclipse which had taken root during Lacan's lifetime. Through his rather distinctive approach of Ferenczi, as Lacan and his follower, for a long time used him as a foil or a stepping stone, as it has been proposed. However, another hypothesis presents itself. Might not the study of Ferenczi, whose radical importance did not escape Lacan, have simply been left fallow? Might Lacan not have separated himself from an author to whom he felt vaguely too close in order to clear in his path outside of Ferenczi's influence, that is, in order to be able to develop his own theoretical tools independently? How can we otherwise understand the present-day interest in Ferenczi's contribution among analysts stemming from older Lacanian circle, who seem amazed to rediscover 30 years later the relevance and richness of a body of work that has long been excluded from their interest? Ferenczi today. In May 2006, a number of Lacanians from different affiliations gathered at the French Institute in Budapest for workshops dedicated to Ferenczi. It was a real event. For some of these colleagues who hold fast to a Ferenczi after Lacan, some of Ferenczi's intuition can only be clarified in light of Lacan's advances. Others ask themselves whether going back to Ferenczi today might not rather allow to break out on the confinement of our French Lacanian circle, and thus to better examine our relation to Lacan and the way we use him to block off a number of things. Manifestly, everyone shows signs of their amazement. Let us consider only two examples. One colleague who, in the wake of Lacan, has taken a keen interest in mystical experiences, is astonished at their proximity to the kind of traumatic experience that Ferenczi talks about in her original way in his clinical diary. Another colleague expressed his surprise. He said, "I choose to follow Ferenczi through one of his most controversial developments, mutual analysis, only to find there, to my great surprise, one of the most elaborate conceptions of psychosis." Lacan would surely have cited it if he were familiar with it. The author cites another excerpt where Ferenczi wants to believe in the possibility of a special group of truly analyzed persons who have the ambition of knowing more than an analyzed persons. This leads our colleague to say that Ferenczi may have intuited something about the ambition of the past and of the school of psychoanalysis. You hear we have 4 points. First one, mystical experiences. Let us think to Orpha and to the clear-sighted child. Second point, mutual analysis, which first concerns feminine passions. Don't forget that Elizabeth Severn was already a psychotherapist before his meeting before to become an analyst with Ferenczi. Third point, psychosis. Other point, the school of psychoanalysis. With these 4 points, did our colleagues try to open 2 new waves of research for them, I think, of course. First, the question, what is femininity? I don't know if this word is correct in English, but I don't try. And what is its part in the ending of psychoanalysis? Second way, with Lacan advances, may we overpass the wounded dialogue between Freud and Ferenczi? Here is for some Lacanian colleagues who think only we can the richness of Ferenczi is given by Lacan, and you understand it's not my position. At the same time, another post-Lacanian cycle, the Society of Freudian Psychoanalysis, has also demonstrated interest in Ferenczi. From its inception, this society has acknowledged the failure of the past, just as Ferenczi came to recognize mutual analysis as a last resort. Its publishing house has since published 4 books dedicated to the work and life of Ferenczi. Is this a real encounter with Ferenczi or merely temporary and circumstantial interest? Only time will tell what will become of this belated discovery of the whole of Ferenczi's work by analysts who are still marked by Lacan's teaching. For my part, I sense here an opportunity to the survival of psychoanalysis itself. Though I would prefer a Ferenczi beyond Lacan to a Ferenczi after Lacan. To conclude, I will read the last sentence of my book. Without the violence of Freud's desire, psychoanalysis would not exist. Without that of Ferenczi, would it still exist? I thank you for your for listening.
Thank you. Thank you, Eve. May I invite the panelists to come up here take your seat, Isabel, Tom. Thank you. Thank you for this wonderful panel. What an important panel. Three giants of psychoanalysis, Jung, Carl Jung, Melanie Klein, and Jacques Lacan, together linked to Ferenczi. And we tried to decipher the intriguing question, how did Ferenczi influence them all?
Désolé. Ah oui, bon, ben, Monsieur Hénal d'abord.
It's just a very rapid question. And I think, to Tom Keefe, I think it's a very important aspect you showed us of the early relationship Jung and Ferenczi. And that brings us to my question. What do you know or what do you think about what is very often that Jung would have been the first analyst of Ferenczi, and that Ferenczi would have analytic sessions in Burghersley before knowing Freud?
I don't know for sure whether somebody can correct me, whether or inform me. Ferenczi went to Zurich. The letter seems to imply that he was there and they forgot something. I don't know what the facts are. Did he actually go to Zurich? The correspondence doesn't seem to be... It seems to be a correspondence of equals rather than one of the two being analyst to the other. So I have no idea. I was fascinated by that one sentence where it says, you have left something here. Could be physical or could be something else.
So that...
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to thank Tom Keefe for introducing us to this, I'm sure, will be fascinating correspondence between the two. And I'd like just to ask two questions, one to Eve and one to, what is your name? Isabel. Thank you. Eve, do you feel that one of the threads that Lacan kept without necessarily mentioning it from Ferenczi was, you know, he said, very early, he said, Ferenczi is the one who helped us to hear and to understand the language of the traumatized child in the adult. And I would link that to Lacan's conception of the history after that, when he says history isn't the past, but it's the past as the past or the past of the trauma, insofar it is historicized in the present. And I think there's there a link with Ferenczi and something that plays, and even when he talks about foreclosure, I think this conception of Ferenczi and the necessity of historization that they both have plays against foreclosure, against its destructivity. But for me, foreclosure is the extreme form of disavowal. And just one little question to Isabel to finish with. Did I hear well? And I would agree. When I heard that you said self-disclosure puts a burden on the patient, and I would say that I agree totally, and I think it puts the patient in the position of the wise baby, of having to take care, and I agree totally with the necessity both to go into the most explosive matters, and at the same time, in order to do that, to have a very very clear boundaries. So thank you to the three of you.
Yes, you heard well. And now what I think, what we did, what I suspect mainly, or how we do follow Ferenczi, is that we absolutely use the countertransference, that we value it, and we kind of feel that it's one of the most important things that we can use. But then the thing is what to do with it, and how can the patient hear it? In what way do we use it? That would be, so in that sense, in the sense of the importance of the countertransference and the importance of being authentic in the sense that I can allow myself to feel what I feel, that it, absolutely we follow Ferenczi. The difference would be how, what do we do with it, technically? So, yes.
We try to answer to you. There is to be schematic, there is to big time in the teaching of Lacan. At the beginning, he privileged the symbolic, the language, perhaps near confusion of language between adults and children. But after, il déplace, is this place the question of trauma, and give less important to the history, to the chapter, the repressed chapter. And in the second time, he privileged the another face of the trauma, like a necessary trauma, a trauma by structure. In language, of course, it's better to for a child to have a good mother able to answer. But in the future, many of our questions, fundamental questions, will remain without response. And that is a new step which is engaged in the psychoanalysis, and the trauma with Lacan, perhaps it's a hypothesis, is no more child abused, sexual abused, or language abused, but yeah, and what happened when man and woman fell in love? What is the destiny of this encounter? And Lacan said it will be necessary, not perhaps traumatic, but a big problem. And he feel in the last, he's near Freud in 1937 with analysis with ending or not ending. Male and female don't speak the same language.
Jonathan Sklar. I want to pay homage, really, to Isabel Holton being here, a client in coming to talk at a Ferenczian conference. And in the spirit of here and now, I want to say how an extraordinary moment of history it is in this country and in the British Psychoanalytical Society. 20 years ago, when Judith and I, with some temerity, perhaps a bit of courage, put on the first Ferenczi conference in the British Society. We did it because Ferenczi was missing. He was wiped out. He wasn't discussed. And we knew, of course, that Melanie Klein's analysis, first analysis, was important, but it wasn't discussed at all. Although many meetings were held in Mansfield House, our old home, Judith and I had a letter from counsel that said, please be aware that the floor does not hold so many people. They were very worried that the floor at the Institute was going to collapse. Now, Judith and I, although we were young analysts, we were analysts and we understood the communication that that there was a sense that something very dangerous was being proposed. And, I mean, 20 years on, the idea that something which in Abraham and Torok's ideas of encryption had been going on, that something was hidden in a crypt and how dangerous it was, it had to be encrypted. This might be a moment where that crypt can be open, that we can begin to have dialogues between Kleinians, independents, contemporary Freudians in our society, beyond that as well. And it might be the beginning of something really, really interesting. I mean, earlier today, we heard about sort of babies not being recognized. Well, the Ferencian project hasn't been recognized in Kleinian thinking forever, really. Now that it can be recognized, it can be seen, we can have sorts of interesting discussions about here and now, the role of history. I want to take issue, for instance, with mutuality, because although Ferenczi did it, he did it by way of an experiment, gave it up because it was impossible. You couldn't free associate if you were thinking, if Ferenczi was on the couch to his patient behind, and his free association was the previous patient, for reasons of confidentiality, he couldn't speak. So it was an experiment which I think we should be pleased he did, that we should be pleased it failed, but it led him to be much more thoughtful in the deeper recesses of what's going on in early enactments of the patient and how the analyst can be sensitive. So I'm very grateful for this as the beginning of perhaps a renaissance. Thank you.
Yes, I would like to speak a little with Isabel.
Sorry, Franco, just one sentence. What I said to Isabel after her presentation and what is really rhyming with you, John, that I just said to her, can I say it? Do you remember the last sentence of Casablanca? Do you?
Yes.
So it was, no, it was, I suppose it's a beginning of a long friendship.
Yes, also in Turin, Kleinian and not Kleinian better had their way of meeting. We are working together with reciprocal satisfaction. But I would like to say that someone of us many years ago wrote that each of us has to be cured for his tendency of idealization. Kleinians need to be cured for their idealization of Melanie Klein and the first Kleinian, and we has also to be cured for our idealization of Ferenczi. But yesterday we were asking why Ferenczi wrote the diary. I think because he was alone. He was alone in a difficult situation, full of despair, and the diary was his companion. As Freud told, put blank on white. From there grows our ability to think. And it is true that Ferenczi is very ingenuous. He was a precox ejaculator, and he dedicates, as I wrote, all the life to heal from this symptom. But I think that all the analysts was precox ejaculators. They speak about thinking, thought, but they don't know for decades what is to think, to let entry into us and let to inhabitate the projective identification. So I defend Ferenczi because he's full of rejecting and ingenuous response. But what the clinical diary has taught to me, that work through a projective identification need time, much time, and also need that before arriving to distinguish, we act some parts of the self, of the patient, and of the object. And today, the Kleinian I knew in Turin, because I was a Kleinian in the 80s, and then no more. But I observe that the Kleinian, nobody will say when we present clinical material, you have to understand quickly a projective identification. They are quiet when the analyst acts a part on the material of the patient, which can be understood in a more complete way by the group, the companion, who help him or her to understand the patient. But reading the clinical diary, he continues. He's an example to continue to think, even if one makes a lot of mistakes. At that time, there is no document of this type in the lecture. But also in the 40s, there is not other kind. Every analyst look at the material of the patient, but no one discuss his way, her way of understanding the patient. But you have told a lot of interesting. I would like to add one thing, because empathy for Ferenczi was not to say a nice thing to the patient. This was is a non-hypocrisy, and in this sense, their enthusiasm and passion in psychoanalysis have this trait also face front the negative. For example, the murderer feeling of the analyst, the hate. The technique was different because Ferenczi, in my opinion, was at the end of his life more near the cry of the young baby. Someone told me that Melanie Klein, before dying, some client when I was supervising in London was listening when she was hospitalized a cry of a little boy desperate, and she was very worried about this cry. I think that Melanie Klein was forced to identify with the aggressor, the mother, and was not so easy for her to feel the cry of the young boy. But reading Melanie Klein, one can see that she was there with the patient, was thinking to the patient for a long time, as we can also observe in Ferenczi.
Just a very quick thought, that in the clinical diary, Ferenczi really traces the evolution of the experiment with mutual analysis, and he concludes mutual analysis is the last resort, and it is preferable to be for the analyst to be well analyzed. And this is the thing that he didn't have that luxury of. And Mrs. Klein had 6 years with Ferenczi and a year and a half with Abraham. With Ferenczi, she was one of the first long-term analysis. I mean, in those years. So, you know, she started off from a different phase. Ferry.
I just wanted to add just short footnotes. Sorry, just very short. Two footnotes. One footnote to Tom. Footnote to Tom. You mentioned Professor Jendrasik. Jung refers to Professor Jendrasik, who was the opponent of psychoanalysis, and he wanted to block Ferenczi's appointment as the chair of psychoanalysis in 1919, but he did block him, in fact, in 1913 when Ferenczi applied for a habilitation at the university, and it was Jendrasik who wrote a very negative opinion on Ferenczi, in spite of another professor of psychiatry whose name was Ernő Moravcsik, and he supported Ferenczi, and he was associated with Jung, I mean Moravcsik, and he had an assistant at the clinic, his name was Géza Csát, another name, he was Josef Brenner, and he's a well-known writer, even his books were translated into English, Géza Csát, and they did together Jungian experiments at the clinic of Budapest, and they called it sentence association, not word association, but they experimented with sentence association, and it's a very interesting chapter in the relationship between Hungarian psychology, psychoanalysis, and Jung, and, you know, Jung visited Budapest when he took part at the alcohol conference, and it was Bleier, I think he was the president of the International Association for Anti-Alcoholism, and so that is an important line, also alcohol and alcoholism. So that's just a footnote, and the other footnote to Lacan, is that Lacan visited Budapest, you know, in the 1970s, when he met with Imre Hermann, and they had a talk on shame, and it was an interpreter who was a famous Hungarian psychologist and group psychotherapist. It was Ferenc Mirei who was the interpreter between two of them, and there's a short description of this encounter. Ferenczi was not mentioned, but they were talking on Imre Hermann, and I think Imre Hermann noted that he didn't understand anything what Lacan said. Thank you.
I just want to make a quick announcement.
Can I just say a word to Ferry, what you said? That's why I was very interested that Jendrasik is already being pointed out as the great opponent in 1907. First year, 1907. That's one thing. Second thing is, last night I was looking at an off-print of the notebooks of Ferenczi, which are also in the museum, and I found a mention of Chart Gazer, Gazer Chart, which you just mentioned, and also a mention of Mrs. Klein.
Well, shall I do? Okay. Well, okay. Well, I have just three very short words, which are thanks. Thanks to everyone. You will see it will turn a little round, a little about. To Mr. Keeve, whom I really thank for the reading I had about 2 years ago of his book Triad, translated in French, whom I'm going to read again. And to Miss Halton, who, asked the right question about counter-intransference. I happen to have written quite a lot about, not speaking of myself, but of one word by Lacan, who said, the resistance is the resistance of the analyst. And I think this is a very good guide rope. And to Yves Lugrin, you'll see. I will here thank Julie Dupont, who has been my coach for more than 40 years through Ferenczi, Balint, etc. I will thank Mrs. Galdi, who asked me for a paper about Balint, which I called Balint After Lacan and After, about 12 years ago. And I'll thank Yves Lugrin for telling me that if I had written it today, I would have called it Balint Beyond Lacan, as he said. And I hope he is going to publish his paper. Thank you.
Just another footnote to Tom and Jung, and also Jonathan, that I think it's a very good way of thinking about these things as encrypted. So encrypted memories, in our history and in our own identity and development. Also, encrypted concepts, not only the projective identification, but I would put in a word for the collective unconscious.
She's provoking us too.
Following directly on from that point, this conference really is about sort of, I suppose, bringing Ferenczi back into the fold and bringing him up from the crypt, so to speak. Will there ever be enough space on the floor to do something similar with Carl Jung, who's, you know, really on the outside of the fold and has been excluded for, you know, for good reason, but there's also much of worth there that could be reconsidered. Will there ever be enough space on the floor for him?
Ferenczi was alone, but I want to remember that he refused the presidency of the Psychoanalytical Society, and Freud was a little angry with him. He argued that he would continue his research, and his research was the diary, the work with the notes. I wanted to ask Tom Keefe why or how could we interpret the fact that Jung letters had survived two world wars and the answers of Ferenczi didn't. And Jung lived in Swiss, who was neutral, and the answers of Ferenczi didn't be preserved. How could we interpret this?
Well, the first part is, I suppose Ferenczi preserved these letters because it meant something to him, even after the Jung-Freud break. The second part, you could say, implies the opposite. That Jung didn't keep Ferenczi's letters, but I've heard rumors from Jungians that there is an enormous amount of Jungian material which the family keeps behind. The bad tongues say for financial reasons, and there's a slow trickle into the marketplace. That's why I actually not only wrote to the archives, but also to the family, because Ivan had a good relationship with them, having visited here, I think last year or year before, and they claim they have nothing else. But as I say, they do have a lot of material, so who knows?
Seems also, as I am not far from Zurich where I live, but I deny it also. it seems even that many of the pieces of the correspondence Bleiler Jung and Freud Jung, the parts which would have kept by the family were lost. So there were movings where some historical material were lost, and it seems now it is an open secret that all this very difficult procedure to publish the Bleiler correspondence, which is really a first place a local interest, was very much retarded by a kind of not shame but embarrassment of the family, because all these pieces, which is part of the local history, would not have been found. So I think that there were something about I don't think it's so much commercial,
because as I know a little, we met the two surviving little sons. I think they are very kind of Protestant Swiss, certainly liking money, because every Swiss likes money, but I don't think that they would the kind of memories and money that is two categories. The one is in the church, the other in the banks.
We have a very lovely friend in France who was saying to me one day, but Ferenczi is not a terrorist. And here we are. We have three we heard three people talking about the great theorician. Three great theoricians and us. The problem with theoricians that they bring us a lot, but as said a Hungarian, another Hungarian, Rado, the analyst beginner starts working to prove the theory. And Ferenczi, for me, in the good sense, wasn't a theoretician. Because when you use the ideas of Ferenczi, you have to advance naked. And another thing, for me, it's not by chance that we are coming to Ferenczi now as analysts. We live in another age. We don't want so much the theoricians. Now we need to advance a bit more naked.
Hi. Freud's been sort of the underlying name that hasn't really been mentioned too often in our session. And I just wondered if there was anyone here, seeing as we have so many senior attendees, who can say whether or not Freud actually read Ferenczi's diary. Did he read it in Vienna, or did he read it here when he was in London?
Can I first of all echo Jonathan's sentiments to Isabel? I think it's a momentous occasion, actually. We were talking in the break about the controversial discussions, and in some ways the British society has never quite sort of come to terms with them, I think, and needs to do. And this truly is momentous, and I look forward to many more discussions of the same openness. I was reminded when Franco was talking about Melanie Klein and the child, the child in pain, when Klein was in hospital, of Sylvia Payne, who knew Klein well, of course, saying, and this was in a public meeting at the British Society to honour Klein, that Klein was like a medium. Now, I don't think in any way, at least consciously, she was criticizing Klein. She said she was like a medium precisely because she could let patients inhabit her. And Payne herself wrote a very interesting paper on the medium. Now, it's curious then for me, and it may be a curious bit of the history of psychoanalysis, that as I understand it, Klein was not too keen on talking about her supervisees' so-called countertransference. She would say that belongs with your analysis. And it may be part of an interesting bit of history, because I think she must, I mean, it's inconceivable, given that medium-like quality, that she wouldn't have valued her own supervisees' capacity to put themselves in the place of their patients. But I think it maybe it was thought about more as empathy than countertransference. And I think there's a huge confusion between the term countertransference and empathy. We write as if Paula Hyman suddenly discovered something called countertransference. It had been around from the very, including in forensic, from the very early stages of psychoanalysis, but it was known as empathy. So it's a curious thing. The other question to Tom really is where Ernest Jones fits in. I mean, there are these three, but Jones comes into the picture, including the, in the trip to America. And of course, there's increasing correspondence between Freud and Jones that we have published from that period. So how does he fit in? It's a rather complicated picture. He wasn't mentioned at all in the letters. I thought it was curious, yeah.
Just very briefly, it was interesting yesterday by sheer coincidence, because I had already prepared my talk. I was listening to, in the Melanie Klein website, there's a talk about Melanie Klein by Ron Britton and Edna O'Shaughnessy. And if you listen to it, it's quite moving, the recognition that they give to Ferenczi. And so that there's obviously something shifting. And they clearly kind of give a lot, and they basically value his contribution of unconscious fantasy. So if you ever have the time, do listen to that.
Sorry, different topic. You will notice that nobody else was mentioned either. Especially the first half, so the first three letters in 1907, very much a personal, you know, that's why I called it friendship, is they really talk to each other about each other. As I recall, Jones, I mean, the first mention of Jones really seems to be in 1909 when he came to Clark University. He didn't come from the UK. I think he was in Canada. Yeah. So he was simply the local, I think, and only became a substantial figure later on. No? Okay, I'm sure you know more about it. Yes? In 1908? Oh, okay. Yes. So my best answer really is nobody else is mentioned either. Grosses.
I would like to answer to Eva, I try to answer to you. Is Ferenczi a theorician or no? You said he is not, and I agree with you. But we must add that at the end of his life, he touched the worst question for the community analytic. And I think all communities analytic has been traumatized by what is soulevé, what is relieved by this question. And I think we must not forget, I can repeat, but we heard it on Friday evening with Christopher. These patients mutual psychoanalysis were first women. Why? Not the hysteric woman that Freud early heard, but another feminine suffering, which he met with a woman who want to become analyst. He discovered the trauma, child trauma, in the discourse of a woman, I think of Elizabeth about Elizabeth VII, who was yet, I repeat, a therapist. She yet wrote a book which can be read today, and so I think we must not forget that, because I think no ideal, we must not idealize Ferenczi without forget his part of scandal, which remains. The scandal brings in by psychoanalysis.
Just a brief. I liked a good comment, Ken, when arrived the time to speak freely about Jones. I think it will arrive when we are ready to a mutual forgiving.
Thanks. Just two short comments. One is that it's important to remember. I mean, it's not. It's. I think it should remember that the Clark conference is a hugely important event in the history of psychoanalysis. It wasn't that important for the attendees of the Clark conference. What I want to say is that Freud and Jung were not the most prestigious speakers. If we are talking, for example, the anthropologist Franz Boas, for example, who was much more popular, much more known than Freud, and mainly William James, the great philosopher. So, and probably there is also this myth that once the American heard Freud's voice in this Clark conference, they all been converted to psychoanalysis. It took a bit more than that. But the other thing is that you, Jonathan, mentioned before the and also Ken, the new discussion between Kleinian and Ferencian. Yesterday, I also heard from Emmanuel and from Ken some new thoughts about, it's not a new thought, but about the close affinities between Freud and Ferenczi. And I think it should. I mean, I believe that there was a historical moment in the 1980s, 1990s that it was important to emphasize the differences between the two, and how. And there are, of course, tremendous differences between how they thought many things. One can say everything, but I don't think so. I think that in a sense, maybe a time has come to revise this vision and to see how they are, after all, connected to the same project. So I think the same way that we look for the affinities between Lacan and Ferenczi, Klein and Ferenczi, Jung and Ferenczi, we should also look at some of the close affinities between Freud and Ferenczi.
Can I just reply?
Yeah, I would like to give a chance to the panel to respond, and then we have to stop.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very briefly to the comment about Clark University, I think what I said was psychoanalysts consider it to be a very important occasion. In fact, it was a totally unimportant occasion. Clark University is a Timpot university. It was only in existence for 25 years at the time, and this was their attempt to come onto the world stage by inviting people from all over the world to give talks. Today, if you ask anybody who is not a psychoanalyst about Clark University, they will never not have heard of it. And if you happen to have read my book, which is on sale somewhere, you will find that there were indeed some very famous people there, quite specifically two Nobel Prize winning, well, one got a physics prize, one got a chemistry prize, Albert Michelson and Rob. That's my comment.
Just following what, I don't know your name, what you were saying, I think it is so important, the whole process of not idealizing our ancestors. Exactly. Our beloved, and ourselves in the process. And what a painful process of mourning that is, of kind of coming to be able to accept reality, but in the process it allows linking. And I think going back to the importance of being able to link, and that hopefully this is, as Judith was saying, the beginning of more linking. So that, yes.
I think we must keep the difference between Freud and Ferenczi not to the cult of the opposite, but only to make them speak, to put words on one about what lies between the wounded dialogue of Freud and Ferenczi.
Thank you so much. Fantastic panel, fantastic participation. Bon appétit.